Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and every week I'm going to be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. I hope everyone had a lovely weekend. I finally noticed some neighbors putting up their Halloween decorations, and I was very happy because I was starting to get worried that we were going to be the only ones on our block in the Halloween spirit this year. Normally, I notice the decorations going up at the beginning of October, but I don't know, maybe it's because we had such a warm start, people just delayed it a bit until the typical fall weather really kicked in. So I am very happy to have started seeing the lawns decked out and the pumpkins carved. I love it. I also want to remind everyone that there's still time to enter our contest. We are giving away a $500 Amazon gift card to one of you. And entering is very simple. Just head on over to @hauntedhistorypod on Instagram, click the giveaway post, and follow the entry instructions in the caption. The draw will take place on Halloween via Instagram Live, so make sure you give a follow so you get the updates when we announce the winner. Now, time to get to today's story. Imagine a wealthy, beautiful countess living alone in a dark castle, bathing herself in the blood of young virgins in order to retain a youthful glow. This is the aura that surrounded Elizabeth Báthory of Hungary, a woman who has been labeled as one of history's most prolific serial killers, with vampiric tendencies on top of that. But when it comes to the so-called Blood Countess, what's fact and what's fiction? Today, we're diving into the world of one of history's most enigmatic women. In doing so, we'll hear about royal rivalries that would give Game of Thrones a run for its money, and accounts of gore that tied to the likes of Vlad the Impaler. Content warning: today's episode contains depictions of gore and body horror. Around Christmas time in 1610, Gheorghe Thurzo climbed a sparsely treed hill overlooking the village of Cheta in the backwoods part of the Kingdom of Hungary. Before him, perched above the village, lay Cheta Castle, a Gothic masterpiece sitting imposingly on the hill. Thurzo, a newly appointed Palatine of Hungary, was a high-ranking representative of King Matthias of Hungary. A devout Lutheran, he was intent on investigating reports that had been seeping through the countryside. The rumors alleged that girls had been disappearing from the village and neighboring areas. Even daughters of the gentry weren't exempt. Whispers about blood sacrifices and acts of barbaric torture had finally reached the king's court. Now, to the king, missing servant girls was one thing, but missing nobles, another thing entirely. Armed with this knowledge, Gheorghe Thurzo burst into the doors of Cheta Castle on that wintry night, totally unaware of what lay behind those walls. Elizabeth Báthory of Hungary was born on August 7th, 1560, prosperous and in a house of privilege. Born into the House of Báthory, a family that ruled the semi-independent Principality of Transylvania in the Kingdom of Hungary, Elizabeth was a wealthy, powerful, well-educated woman, and by all accounts, beautiful. She took her first steps at the sprawling family estate in Nyírbátor, and was raised in a castle named Ecsed. She was said as having a cream-colored complexion and raven-black hair. Having all of those things is one thing, but much of Elizabeth's legacy is marked by what others thought she would do with her lot in life. And so, she was often tried as much for what she did as what she didn't do. The Báthorys would often intermarry, and there is evidence that because of this, many Báthorys suffered from incest-induced mental illness and other genetic disorders. For example, Elizabeth's uncle, some sources say cousin, Stephen Báthory, who at one time was the king of Poland and voivode of Transylvania, was known to have epileptic attacks. Her grandfather, in turn, was known to ride sleighs in the middle of summertime. Elizabeth, for her part, inherited the same seizures. She was also prone to debilitating migraines and terrible mood swings. Around the age of 10, Elizabeth was betrothed to Ferenc Nadasi, who was himself a member of another high-ranking Hungarian family and a man 5 years older. The marriage, like most during that time, was a political affiliation, and at just 13, young Elizabeth was sent off to the court of her future mother-in-law in order to be taught how to manage a household. It's said that while she was there, Elizabeth had a baby with a man of a lower social status, a commoner, named Laszlo Bend. It's said that Ferenc, in a fit of brutality that perhaps would shape Elizabeth's future worldview, had the man castrated and torn apart by dogs. The child that Elizabeth birthed, her daughter, was sent off to the province of Wallachia to be raised by a woman who was warned never to return during Elizabeth's lifetime. So Elizabeth got herself into a situation, and the problem simply went away, further shaping her relationship to consequence. Her daughter, who was deemed a nuisance, was disposed of. Her fling with Laszlo was swept under the rug. As for Laszlo, the fact that he was a peasant no doubt played against him. And he lost his life in the most brutal of ways, I might add, for his part in the ordeal. The disposability of peasants was rampant during this time, as their sole purpose in a kingdom was to serve the nobility. They were, for all intents and purposes, owned by the nobility. On May 8, 1575, shortly after this incident, Elizabeth and Ferenc married in a lavish 3-day ceremony held at the Palace of Verano in present-day Slovakia. They were now the Count and Countess of Báthory, and the marriage allowed for the consolidation of large lots of land belonging to both families, spanning from Hungary to Transylvania. The festivities lie in stark contrast to the searing brutality of the events leading up to it. As a token of what can be construed of his love, Ferenc gifted his new bride an entire castle. Csáta Castle was initially built in the 13th century in Romanesque style, with heavy stones and a horseshoe-shaped residence tower. By the time Elizabeth Báthory would be gifted this impressive domain, it was redesigned in a more Gothic style that's rather fitting to this story. The castle grounds and all surrounding villages were also a part of Ferenc's wedding present to Elizabeth. This gesture, of course, was extremely grandiose, but what's more, the act itself also cemented the subconscious belief that the people that lived in the surrounding lands and villages also belonged to Elizabeth and could be used as she pleased. Elizabeth and Ferenc were married for 3 years before he set off to war. As we touched upon in previous episodes, like our episode on Bran Castle and Vlad the Impaler, the 16th and 17th centuries were extremely tumultuous and violent in this region. The Kingdom of Hungary was routinely battling the Ottoman Empire, as well as feudal factions within its own territory. Ferenc, true to the demands of his role and upbringing, was an ambitious soldier who set off campaigning against the Ottoman Turks. In 1591, the long Turkish War began. This war would last around 15 years, and during its time, Ferenc would be labeled the Black Knight, a nickname that he would earn due to his unbelievable cruelty. It's said that he liked to get creative with his methods of torture, and for fun, Ferenc would toss a pair of Turkish prisoners up in the air, only for them to land on the tip of his sword. For her part, Elizabeth spent her time alone, floating between her various estates, managing a household, as she had been taught to at her mother-in-law's court. When Ferenc returned sporadically from battles, the Count would shower his Countess with gifts. It's said that knowing or perhaps feeding into his wife's growing sadistic tendencies, Ferenc gifted Elizabeth with a pair of gloves that had long claws in order for Elizabeth to better thrash her servants. What's more, it's said that Ferenc taught Elizabeth a little trick that he called kicking the stars. It consisted of dipping a piece of paper in oil, placing it between an idle servant's fingers, and setting it on fire. This is obviously not the first time that Ferenc displayed sadistic tendencies, but Elizabeth seemed to take to it well. Whether or not she harbored her own sadistic desires remains a matter of historical debate. Either way, her husband either fanned the flames or planted the seed. The couple mainly lived on an estate in Sever in Hungary. They kept the Báthory name, as Elizabeth's family was higher in rank than Ferenc's. They would have four children during their marriage. While Ferenc was away at war, Elizabeth took it upon herself to orchestrate the defense of their lands from invaders. Sever was especially susceptible, as it was located on the border between the royal side of Hungary and the side that was under Ottoman occupation. Elizabeth was therefore in charge of protecting these lands while her husband was away. But this was not all she did. She was also known to take many lovers and was no stranger to taking trips herself. In a 2002 book titled Vampire, a Symbolic Biography by Polish literary theorist Maria Janion, states that Elizabeth even visited a mysterious Aunt Clara in Vienna, who introduced her to various states of licentiousness and so-called lesbian orgies. This may be a kernel of truth amidst the larger idea that Elizabeth's open extramarital affairs as a woman contributed to her eventual downfall. It also suggests, perhaps, even her sexual orientation played into her later demonization. Some academics, like the associate professor of the University of Lodz, have said that Elizabeth started filling her residences with a revolving door of interesting characters. Although largely unconfirmed, it's said that one of her Aunt Clara's servants, named Thorko, introduced Elizabeth to the world of the occult. Soon, Sheta Castle was crowded with self-proclaimed sorcerers, witches, alchemists, wizards, and occultists. It's even rumored that Elizabeth started dabbling in occultism herself, making home remedies, potions, and poultices. What's really interesting about this time in Elizabeth's life is that we can truly see the merging of storytelling and fact. Most of the stories that would spill out from this time would be word-of-mouth accounts put forth by the oppressed peasant class. Let's not forget, Elizabeth was a woman who was known for her beauty, wealth, and power. She also, it seems, was prone to cruelty. Given this, it's not unreasonable to think that there's a chance the oppressed class would start to fabricate reasons to explain her seemingly favorable situation. What's more, there's an element of gossip that borders on warning when it comes to this outlook. Because the targeted victims of Elizabeth were from the peasant class, it stands that they would be the ones spreading awareness of her misdeeds in order to protect their own. Elizabeth's sadistic side is said to have begun around 1585. She believed, strangely, that the screams of those being tortured would alleviate her raging migraines. At Sever Castle, Elizabeth began tormenting her servants, those she viewed as disposable, especially her maids. Some of her methods of torture included putting needles under her maids' fingernails and cutting off their fingers. Other methods included pouring scalding hot water over the girls and leaving them outside in the dead of winter to freeze to death. Another was dousing them in honey and letting them be tormented, in some cases to death, by insects. That last one was an idea of Ferenc's. It was also said that Elizabeth would use red-hot pliers to tear apart the bodies of her servants. Nothing off-limits. One of her favorite methods of torture was to stab her servants with scissors. She would also sew her seamstresses' mouths shut if they made a mistake. Elizabeth's torture seemed to be centered around pain, humiliation, and bodily mutilation. She also seemed to relish in stripping women naked. Needless to say, the body count started piling up, quite literally. The servants' deaths were chalked up to an ongoing cholera epidemic, with funeral rites and burials being undertaken by a local clergy. A local Lutheran pastor became suspicious of the sheer number of dead girls being churned out of Elizabeth's residences. He demanded the public exhumation of the girls' bodies and pleaded with the count to reel in his wife's bloodlust, but to no avail. In 1601, Elizabeth's husband, Ferenc, developed a debilitating pain in his legs, which eventually evolved into permanent disability in 1603. In 1604, the count succumbed to his mysterious illness. Elizabeth's involvement in her husband's passing is debatable. However, it does seem like his death correlates to her ramping up her nefarious behaviors. After her husband's death, Elizabeth moved permanently to Shaeta Castle. By then, hundreds of girls had been reported missing all through Elizabeth's lands. Locals began whispering of the Blood Countess and the Beast of Shaeta, and she was only getting started. Legend has it, after a maid left some hair out of place in Elizabeth's hairdo, the Countess struck the young woman very violently. The resulting nosebleed left a splash of blood on Elizabeth's cheek. The Countess paused and marveled at the softness of her skin and how rejuvenated it looked under the bright red streak on her face. She raised her hand feebly to her cheek, her mind racing. The Count had just died, and Elizabeth, facing her own mortality, confused power with permission. This, coupled with delusion, gave her the license to ramp up her maniacal tendencies. If one splash of virginal blood could help her retain a youthful glow, imagine what a tubful could do. The legend seemed to grow and morph over time, with the idea evolving into Elizabeth literally drinking the blood of her victims. It's said that Elizabeth's bloodlust began to reach a crescendo. During this time, she is reported to have been known to bite her victims' breasts, arms, and necks, using her body to inflict direct violence upon theirs. This can be viewed through the lens of perhaps a sexual sadist, something which has historically been allocated to male serial killers throughout history. It's interesting to note that Elizabeth Báthory's timeline is sandwiched between two historically significant serial killers, feudal French nobleman Gilles de Rais and Jack the Ripper, a notorious product of the industrial age. The idea that a woman could be a prolific sexual sadist is not common, but Elizabeth had the means to live out her wildest fantasies and be largely free of consequence. That is, however, until she sidestepped from her tried-and-true mode of operation. Sadly, alarm bells didn't go off when slews of peasant girls went missing, but when the daughters of local nobles began disappearing, the pleas started resonating ever so louder. One of the people who sympathized with these pleas was another pastor, a young man called Janos. Following her husband's death, Elizabeth created a gynecium in her castle. A gynecium is a place where the young daughters of the local gentry can go to learn proper etiquette. There was only one problem. The girls that attended Elizabeth's school often ended up disappearing. As such, the rumblings extended beyond her estates and reached the court of King Matthias of Hungary. Now, it should be noted, at the time, King Matthias actually owed a sizable amount of money to the Báthory family. Historically, it's possible that this fact either informed the accusations levied against Elizabeth or spurred the king to act on the hearsay. In 1610, King Matthias assigned Georgi Thurzo to investigate. You'll remember Georgi from our opening scene. Meanwhile, during the same year, Janos was tasked with taking charge of a church in the village of Cheta. The closer Janos got to the village, the louder the rumblings were. A blood countess, the vampire, the beast of Cheta. Janos saw very few young women in the village square and quickly spotted a castle looming over the town. He knew of the widowed countess who lived there, and he took it upon himself to pay her a visit, see what all the fuss was about. It's said that once he set foot inside Shaita Castle, a weighed gloom fell upon him. The countess, then in her 50s, seemed to glide toward him. Her beauty, although faded, retained a mark of the extraordinary, not unlike the evil queen in Snow White. Janos was left shaken by the encounter, and especially the muted demeanor of the countess' servants. As he began to prepare his tenure as the local pastor, he rifled through paperwork. What he found were written notes detailing the horrors happening behind the closed doors at Shaita Castle, written by the previous pastor, who had since passed away. Namely, the long list of young women who had died in service of the countess, and the curious nature of said deaths. Janos explored the town grounds, including the crypt where the servants' bodies were reported to be entombed. When Janos found the boxes where the servants' bodies were, he opened them. Inside, he found the mutilated bodies of 9 girls in various states of decay. Their bodies had been visibly mangled, and the boxes were caked in blood. Legend has it that Thurzo caught the Countess Elizabeth Báthory in the middle of a torture session. The corpse of a young girl lay strewn out just outside the castle in the courtyard, still warm to the touch and caked in blood. The girl was a Croatian servant who had stolen a pair during Christmas time. She had been beaten for a whole night before finally being stabbed to death with scissors. What's more, Thurzo found a half-alive young woman tethered in a chamber. She had been rendered the unfortunate victim-turned plaything of a woman lacking any humanity. Thurzo, it said, tabled his horror just long enough to place the countess under immediate arrest. Along with Elizabeth, 4 of her servants were also taken in as accomplices. As a Palatine of Hungary, Gheorghe Thurzo could exercise the will of the king where need be. He was also related to the Báthory family by marriage. Perhaps because of this, Thurzo gave Elizabeth a speedy trial that lasted merely one day. She was also allowed to redistribute her lands to her surviving children. What's more, Elizabeth was saved from execution for the crime of murder or witchcraft and was essentially put under house arrest for the remainder of her days. This meant the king's debt still had to be paid. Now, the same leniency, of course, was not extended to her accomplices. Needless to say, she had a scapegoat for this whole ordeal. 2 of Elizabeth's female servants were sentenced to have their fingers torn away with hot pincers before being thrown alive in a fire. A male servant, because of his young age, was given a leaner sentence. He was decapitated and thrown into the fire. The 4th accomplice was acquitted. Interestingly, Elizabeth's trial would have gone unnoticed through most of history were it not for a Jesuit scholar named Father Laszlo Tarocsi, who uncovered her trial records in 1720. As I mentioned earlier, Elizabeth's last victim was a servant girl from Croatia. The implication is that by then, local women were shying away from working in the service of the so-called Blood Countess. In the book Female Serial Killers, How and Why Women Become Monsters, author Peter Vronsky theorizes that Elizabeth made a fatal mistake by targeting young women from the impoverished gentry. Desperate to restore their social status, and perhaps having been given a glimmer of hope by association, these families would have been conned into trusting Elizabeth with their daughters, but still carried considerably more social traction than members of the peasant class. During the trial, it was put forth that Elizabeth had tortured and killed up to 650 girls. 224 witnesses are said to have testified to Elizabeth's diabolical impulses. If her murderous career spanned the better part of 30 years, this would mean that Elizabeth may have murdered around 19 to 20 girls per year, which, given the expendable nature of people in the eyes of nobility, was not entirely inconceivable. All in all, it's safe to say that Elizabeth's aura is probably less vampiric and more sadistic, Or it could have also been a targeted attack aimed at robbing a somewhat sexually liberated woman of her agency. One thing is for certain. A very real aura of evil hangs around Elizabeth Báthory. As we have learned from the likes of modern murderers such as Carla Homolka, sexual sadism in the true crime realm is not only reserved for male serial killers, although it's much more common. What's more, if Elizabeth did commit these crimes, she acted after her husband's passing, meaning that she did not require a dominant male counterpart to execute these crimes, as they are so often characterized by modern true crime. No. Elizabeth's apparent co-conspirator would have been her extreme societal privilege, which afforded her the allowance to act with impunity. Because part of Elizabeth's apparent torture process involved stripping her victims naked, it's not unreasonable that sexual sadism was a prime motivator for her. Whether or not some of the more outlandish acts that she's said to have committed are true, the blood drinking and bathing and flesh eating, for example, remains a debatable matter that has been no doubt embellished by history. One thing is for sure, the twisted hierarchy of the value of human life that was present at that time, coupled with the idea that sociopathy and psychopathy could be explained by the paranormal or ghoulish, cannot be discounted. This, after all, is how stories originate, how legends are bred and built. We make stories to make sense of the world around us, to catalog the unthinkable, and sometimes to warn each other of the evil presence in the castle up on the hill. Well, that's it for me today. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you all next Tuesday.